But then on the other hand, I feel bad. I totally fuck up grandpa's house.
That's the problem with killing vampires. They're hell on your fucking plumbing.
Because calls all my goop just like just backs up the plumbing in the whole house. That's a lot of goop. That's he produced a lot of goop.
Like, so he's Vampire Drano? Is that what that is? Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time is here. That's right. We're talking about 1987's The Lost Boys on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you once again from Santa Clara, California, the murder capital of the world. This is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we watch a horror movie and we talk about horror movie characters and the order in which they die in the hopes that a teen vampire's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes we can make at their expense. And as always, there's only one person to trust who knows where to place the Superman comics so that the canon makes sense. The one, the only, Gina Radcliffe. How are you doing today, Gina?
I gotta tell you, I remember Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, yes.
Remember Bill Murray and how he's sitting in the chair and he's just kind of like bicycle pumping his legs because he's so excited about his dentist appointment.
Right.
That's me talking about this movie. So excited that it pains me. It breaks my heart to have to do this. But Patrick, I have to correct you.
Oh.
You said Santa Clara.
Oh,
it is Santa Carla.
Santa Carla.
I am a Lost Boys pedant. Thank you very much.
Well, it doesn't matter anyways, because Santa Carla doesn't exist and Santa Cruz does. And I've been to Santa Cruz. So there.
Be that as it may.
I'm going to have to go back and edit in Santa Carla instead of Santa Clara or whatever.
No, just leave the correction in. I think it's funnier.
All right, Gina, when was the first time you watched The Lost Boys?
All I have to tell you is that this movie was released 4 days after my 15th birthday. So to say that I was the target audience for this movie, like Joel Schumacher might as well have come to my house and driven me to the theater.
What a fabulous car ride that was.
It would have been great. I would have had stories. He wouldn't have tried anything.
No. Other than try to get you to buy popcorn before you went in to watch the movie.
That I totally would have.
Were you already awakened or did it awaken something inside you?
I was already awakened because I had already seen Fright Night by this point. Because Fright Night had been 2 years earlier. But Fright Night was, you know, and we're going to get to that at some point. Sure. But Fright Night awakened me, if you want to put it that way, in a way that was a little, you know, uncomfortable and intimidating. Because mostly because Chris Sarandon is like my dad's age.
Right, yes.
and like, I'm like, no, I know this makes me uncomfortable. I mean, it makes me uncomfortable in a way that, you know, is supposed to be kind of fun, but, you know, also I was very like, you know, puritanical at that age.
Okay.
So, you know, that was hard to deal with, but these were cute boys. They were boys. They were teenagers.
Yes.
And, you know, it felt okay to kind of just want to hang out with them all night and, you know, hope that they swooped in and carried me away because they were just a bunch of cute boys.
Just one cuter after the other.
Yeah, that opening scene, I was sold on just the opening credits.
Yeah.
That fantastic tracking shot over the ocean. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a chef's kiss shot right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the amusement park, which to me felt very evocative of the seaside amusement parks near Atlantic City, where I grew up.
Of course.
And then when you got that merry-go-round scene, you're basically like, who the fuck is this guy? How many guys are there? And they're all dressed like Adam Ant, and they've got spurs on their boots. And it's like, I have never seen anything like you in my life.
I want to make sure we hit both parts of these things because I think they're both important. Okay. So we're going to table sexy boys for a second. And we're going to talk about something that's rather pervasive when people talk about the Lost Boys that I find semi-infuriating. And that is they constantly refer to the boys of the titular Lost Boys as punk. And ain't nothing punk about these fucking guys. They're new romantics.
They're new romantic with a soupçon, a skosh, as you might say, Patrick, yeah, of goth. But yes, they are not punk.
They are not punk. There are many punks in the movie. The opening credits is full of doofusy surf punks and just complete seaside burnouts. Those people are punk as fuck. But the Lost Boys as a group is projecting something that is from a time gone by. They are not, they don't really flow when you put them in a group of people. They don't look like locals. They look like a gang out of the Warriors next to everyone else.
Right, exactly.
And I don't know exactly what it is. It's just one of those pervasive things like, the teenagers in Friday the 13th movies, it's just been said so many times that people repeat it because they've heard it so many times. It must be a fact. But if we're going to be pedantic about these things, that must be said. So we'll put that one to bed. But we have to get back to sexy boys because I think that is the true revolution of this particular movie that evolves it past where Fright Night sort of reinvigorates the entire vampire mythos, because you're coming out of in the late 70s, early 80s, where I'm trying to think of the movie with George Hamilton. Love at First Bite is a spoof, and that generally kills something off. Like, it's reached something to the point where just the mere mention of it, people go, oh, yeah, I don't find that scary anymore. George Hamilton was a vampire. And so Fright Night reinvigorates it a little bit and certainly brings in the Rear Window element. It's already mixing genres, but it's still a guy. Yeah, that is a man as a vampire.
Right.
And the revolution here is, what if vampires were sexy hotties in Tiger Beat?
Right, this is I would say arguably the first horror movie targeted towards teenage girls.
Right, and I'm sure in the sense that when Warner Brothers got this and it was just this kiddie, and this was literally supposed to be 8-year-old vampires.
Right, it was basically supposed to be like the Goonies but with vampires, and that's right. And that's why. And the funny thing is you can tell they didn't change much of the dialogue.
No.
Because you have Corey Haim as Sam, who is looks to be, I'm guessing by about how old Corey Haim himself, it's about 14.
Yeah.
And Sam needs his big brother to babysit him one night.
Well,
and like his mom is coming to tuck him in, mm-hmm. and you know, he reads very much like a child.
Yes. But I will say, I think that lends itself to one of the subtexts of the movie, in that when it comes to Michael and Sam and Lucy's family, it's one that is, it's been capped off emotionally by this divorce. Lucy is not the same. Michael has arrested himself at a certain point, and so has Sam. And so when they move to this new locale, which isn't a place they've never been to before. They do know Grandpa, but they've never been to his house. And he is kind of arrested at a certain point. He's not a high schooler. He's not a real full-blown teen as opposed to Michael. And Michael is still like playing grab ass and sticking his finger in Sam's ear. Like, there's still that element of their brothers, and they've grown up together, and they have not moved past this thing which kind of froze them at a moment in time. And it's this other family
of vampire sexy teens that that is able to transform them into people who might have different lives after this. Now that is one summation I would close the book on.
No, I agree with you. I think that's a very good and insightful way of looking at it.
Because you have the comic book thing. You have him constantly dressing in what feels like Diane Weiss' rejected costumes for half of this. Whenever he wakes up in the morning, he looks like he is wearing something that his mom has said, I don't need to wear this anymore. It's like, I wear that to bed now.
I do like the one scene where... Michael comes into his room, wakes him up in the middle of the night. He's got like the silk eye mask on.
Right.
He's like a middle-aged woman who's worried about like under eye circles the next morning.
There's only one person I've met who enjoys a bath more than Corey Haim's character in this movie, and that's my son. This is a very specific moment in time where I feel like Sam just doesn't come across as a boy who knows what he wants in this world, right? He's just kind of frozen at a very specific moment. He'll move past it, but this is the summer where he doesn't care about girls.
Yeah, like I think it's funny how like Michael first sees Star, and you know, of course, is absolutely gobsmacked. Who wouldn't be? But Sam is just bemused at this, that like his right. I don't know 18-year-old brother is moony-eyed over some beautiful woman that he sees across this boardwalk, and he's just like, well, good luck with that, I'm going to the comic book store.
Right. Well, at one point he turns his chin back towards the oiled up saxophone player on stage. Let's be serious about this. We're not going to see this guy all the time. You're going to see girls like that constantly. We're in California now. You're going to see boho gypsies. My apologies. But the type, she's wearing goofy hippie skirts and shit. So he's like, come on, Tim Capello, like right in front of us, he's being lit by trash cans on fire. This isn't happening all the time. Or, all right, you're going to go chase skirts. I'm going to go look at comic books. He's just in a different field of development. And I think I love his room. We love a good horror character bedroom, and his is fucking amazing.
Yeah, there you want to talk about random posters on the walls. I mean, we've got the gal from Friday the 13th part 6, was it? Who had like she was a punker, but she had like a Hall & Oates poster
and the Alan Parsons project.
Yeah, Alan Parsons project. That's what I'm thinking.
Right. Yeah. Whereas, Sam has, and just to run through it, a giant swatch on the wall, which I'm a little jealous. I never
that was a thing. Swatch. That was definitely a thing.
Definitely a thing. And he also has a huge Molly Ringwald poster from what appears to be 16 Candles specifically.
But also he's got like a Beefcake poster of Rob Lowe, which I'm like,
Rob Lowe in a hiked t-shirt so to show off his tum tum.
It's like, all right, Sam, you're figuring some things out about yourself. That's all right.
And there's a lot of dichotomy going on here. But he also has a poster for Reform School Girls, which is camp as shit. But he also has that Ferrari poster with just a girl's butt. Like, here's a car and a butt.
He's working some things out. And, bless Lucy for being all right with it, apparently.
There's chaotic bisexual energy throughout this entire bedroom. And then the camper for it, though, is that his grandpa keeps bringing him stuffed mounted animals. And the first two are jokes. And then the third one, he puts this giant owl in his closet and it's full of these animals. Just top to bottom, he's kept bringing them in one after the other. And there's no clothes. It's all stuffed animals. there's... It's kind of genius in that way.
So quick question. Did you ever read the book of the Lost Boys?
Oh, I never did read the book of the Lost Boys. Listened to the soundtrack like it was going.
I was a teenage girl obsessed. I bought the soundtrack. I bought all the teen magazines that had articles about it. I bought the book. I mean, if fanfic had been a thing, you better believe I would have been writing some fanfic, both spicy and not spicy.
Sure.
But no, as is often the case with, I don't actually know off the top of my head if this one was written with an earlier draft of the script, as most of them are. Mm-hmm. But there's a very large subplot that is completely eliminated from the movie of Michael getting a job as working for the sanitation department, specifically to earn money to buy the leather jacket that he ends up buying at the boardwalk, which, you know, in the movie, it kind of seems like a spontaneous purchase he made because Star's like, oh, hey, that would look good on you. And he's like, all right, how much?
Yes. And it is the furthest from the dandyish, swashbuckling Lost Boys as you can get. There's even members only lapelettes on the shoulders. That's how uncool that leather jacket is.
I had to ask, like, would the weather ever be cool enough there to require such a jacket? It's kind of hard to tell what time of year it is supposed to be.
Yeah, that is that is undetermined. Like, is it the summer? And our summers are weird because summers don't really start until July and they don't end till the 1st of October. So,
it is true that the Frog Brothers are apparently working full time at their parents' comic book shop.
Well, their parents might be dead. We never see them alive.
I'm sorry, they remind me of my own parents.
I'm assuming the joke here is that they are so stoned they are comatose, but we never see them move ever. So I'm assuming that that's not their mummified remains. As far as like whether or not it would be warm enough, you know, you are by the beach. The temperature does drop precipitously in two places, the beach and the desert. And at night, it can be very cool in both places.
True.
Is it full-length woven duster weather? I don't know. Again, Corey Haim's costuming should put somebody in the Hague. A few weeks ago, we talked about what an Australian nightmare is. He is dressed like a tween Australian nightmare.
I got to say that nobody's outfit, save maybe for the Frog Brothers, really reflect what 87 teenagers were wearing.
Well, it's either so completely 1987, like there's no two patterns we won't put together. The audaciousness of boat collared surf wear is very 87, at least for California. But yes, there's other things that just seem like out of a time warp. Like, my God, what is going on here? And yet Tim Capello seems perfectly fine, shirtless, oiled within an inch of his life.
Yeah, but he's got those fire barrels. He's surrounded by fire barrels, though.
It's true. He's drawing a lot of warmth from oil barrels.
And from the love of the crowd.
True. That crowd is really into he's
got like this Tina Turner backup saxophone player has got a large audience of headbangers.
Yes. I would not put this Tim Capello particularly or this song in the surf punk anthem of all time. And yet they are into it. Like, and maybe it's just a lack of other concerts. Maybe Fishbone really rules this town. Fishbone, local Southern Cal, you know, band that, you know, toured forever. They had a brass section. Sure, they're more second wave ska punk, but still, it's a bit of a reach. I also, this is perhaps my second favorite Tim Capello performance. My first being the music video for the Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome theme from Tina Turner, where he's playing sax in that. And he seems completely in the Mad Max universe. Like, did you did he survive the nuclear apocalypse? He doesn't seem out of place, Gina.
He like ducked down between behind those fire barrels and you know he survived the brunt of the blast.
That's the best place to do it. The fire, the heat of a nuclear blast can't get to you. You already have fire.
Exactly.
It's the perfect scenario.
Exactly.
So I'll warn everyone, we're not going to go through the plot.
Who doesn't know the plot of the
I would
hazard a guess, and don't anybody bother trying to argue with me because I will not listen to you. I think this counts as an iconic movie.
Oh, I absolutely think it's an iconic movie. I think its legend looms larger than the film itself, is my guess, because it literally, you don't have an entire genre of 90s and 2000s, you know, both cinema and particularly on television without the Lost Boys. It is a keystone in the sexy teen monster genre.
Right. I mean, it because it's up to this point, you know, certainly the 70s into the 80s, you know, the vast majority of horror featuring teenagers is slasher movie.
Yeah.
So to, you know, offer something like this is a bit of a revelation. And, yeah. You know, I had been into horror by this point, but again, this felt like something that had been made specifically for me.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of things that are wrapped up into it that you find paying off down the line. One of which would be the soundtrack, as I mentioned before, was something that I owned and I played ad nauseum. And Schumacher was instrument. That was not something that was like called out in the script or that Warner Brothers said, we've got an entire, you know, music division, so make sure you use that. This is Schumacher saying this needs to appeal to teens, even though an R-rated film means they might need a parent to get them inside. This will live now on VHS forever. So you got to have a soundtrack that makes people pump their fists a little bit, that feels attuned with the times. So he's the one who reaches out to INXS. And they're like, we don't really do soundtracks. And he goes, do me a favor and I'll do you one in return. And eventually we will get to his music video for INXS, which is, I would say, Lost Boys 1.25.
Sure.
And then he's the one who he's friends with Ray Manzarek from The Doors. And he suggests that they re-record People Are Strange with a hot band at the time. And Manzarek is producing Echo and the Bunnyman's new disc. So he brings them in to do this. And then he's the one who finds Cry Little Sister, which is
you know, probably the song, you know, even though you know, nobody has heard from the singer or, you know, at the time or heard from him since, that the song most people remember. And what's funny is the opening, they do use an instrumental version of it during the opening titles, which,
right,
you know, really much really does kind of set the whole vibe for the movie. It's a really, really good selection. But I don't believe that one was made into a video. The other two songs that were made for a video was the INXS song, which was Good Times, I think it was called.
Yes, which is a remake of a 60s garage rock tune by the Easy Beats. If you've never heard the Easy Beats version of that song, I cannot stress hard enough that you must go out and find and listen to it. It fucking rules. And I never heard it at this time. And I had just viewed it as an INXS song. And then later, like, oh, there's a whole original version of it. Fucking rules.
And you know, the INXS version ain't bad either. I listened to it on the way home from work tonight in preparation. And then the other one was the one that actually mentions the phrase Lost Boys in the chorus. Yeah. And that's Lou Gramm from Foreigner.
Right.
So these were all hot names at the time it was released.
And one can argue that Tim Capella's performance has, I think, lived the longest in some ways because it is that gif that you will see once a week. People will find an excuse to put the gif of him blowing into that saxophone shirtless.
And just like pelvic thrusting at the same time, which is like, that takes talent, man.
I mean, I almost had Josh put him in this episode's artwork. Like, I was inches away.
I feel like it is one of those movies that a lot of people enjoy looking back on and saying, it wasn't that good. Like, doesn't matter if it wasn't good. I mean, I think it's great. But, its influence is still felt 35 years later.
Yes. Because you would not have the Buffy the Vampire Slayers. You would not have the Twilights. You would not have the Vampire Diaries. You would not have the litany of CW sexy monster shows that I nearly ran out of words trying to describe. They all owe a portion of their DNA to the Lost Boys. And as a result of the Lost Boys, I think that the attitude of how we treat teenagers in a movie eventually results in something like a Scream. There is a line between those two things where it's like, yes, obviously we have to cast people who are above the age of 18, but we're casting them as teenagers to evoke a young vibe. And the young vibe is just at the core of what The Lost Boys is as a motion picture. They have to appear to people to be appealing. It's not just that a vampire is so unbelievably attractive that when he sucks my blood, I have an orgasm. This is, I would like to have an orgasm with them all the time.
I just want to hang out and party because they seem super cool.
Yeah. Name another vampire previous to the Lost Boys that is so cool, you'd like to hang out with them.
Well, that was that great tagline on the poster, which was sleep all day, party all night. It's fun to be a vampire. And you know what? That sounds fucking great.
Right.
I mean, it makes me tired to think about now. That's because I'm old. But when I was 15, I was like,
there's just elements of this that are transformed from its original vision. What I'm told was, there was a little period of pocket of time where, like volcanoes and like meteor movies or whatever, or Die Hard Zana, there was a period of time where everyone had a Peter Pan tank. And so this was originally sold as, what if the Lost Boys were vampires and basically a scout troop fights them? And it just existed for a really long time. And after The Goonies hits as hard as it does, Warner Brothers, who owns this, tries to sell him on it. And he reads it and he's not particularly impressed by it. But there's something that goes off in his wife, Lauren Shuler Donner's head, that there's stuff here that you could do something with. There's something in the air, you know. It's not cops, they're MTV cops. All of a sudden you have Miami Vice. Well, what if you have MTV vampires? So they push for someone they had worked with before to come on board as the director. And that, it, of course, is Joel Schumacher. He's the one who says, we need a new script. Let's bring on someone that you like here. And let's try to make something out of this that's both scary and sexy and funny. And Warner Brothers goes, that's a great idea. That will be the last time they say that until this movie is nearly released. They do not believe in it. They think it kind of sucks. And they think everyone involved is crazy. But because the Donners have this crazy run going with Warner Brothers, because he turns down this as an opportunity to direct and says, we'll produce, and goes on to do Lethal Weapon, which Warner Brothers loves. So he is their brightest star at the moment. So they're like, okay, fine. And so Donner, you know, starts making music decisions, starts casting people. And when he starts casting people, this is where he runs into another bit of problems, because you could argue that the biggest stars in this movie at the time it was cast was Corey Feldman coming in hot off of Gremlins, Goonies, and watching two guys dig up a Jason Voorhees corpse to have sex with it in Friday the 13th, Part 5. And Oscar winner Diane Wiest. This is her follow-up to winning a fucking Oscar, Gina.
Yeah, this is interesting because this is, I believe, this is the first pairing of the Coreys.
Yes.
Which was a thing. Now, this was by far their best movie.
Right, it was all downhill from here.
Right, because yes. You've got their follow-up, which was License to Drive, which is fine. I remember being, mildly amused by it, but I doubt it's aged very well. Then you've got Dream a Little Dream, which I've been told is an iconic movie from my teen years. I don't believe people when they tell me that. Because
everyone's got their something, Gina. I don't doubt people's genuine emotional reactions to art. This is where I start to vary a little bit, but okay, sure, fine.
And then you've got a movie they did, which you had to see them both have a sex scene. And I'm like, nope, I don't want that.
Well, you're going to get it. One of these years, we're going to have to cover it for After Dark because... You know we're going to have to get into it, but
I suppose
I don't trust Feldman once he gains Michael Jackson hair.
No,
I find that suspect.
He's a tragic figure who is also very much a creep in his own way.
Right.
And whereas Corey Haim is pretty much just a tragic figure.
Yes. For Feldman, his background is an explanation. It is not an excuse. And of course, Haim is hampered by a great many things. Many of them drug related, some of them sexual, just being, it sounds like a fucking nightmare. But this, I would also argue, is Haim's what would propel him to any idea of stardom. Because in this movie, he is quite good.
Yeah, he's very charming. He's very much like, the sort of little brother character that, he's just on the cusp of being a little annoying, but in a way that a little brother usually is. He's very believable in that role. His concern for Michael feels very genuine.
Yeah.
And he's kind of, he's kind of the cornerstone of the movie.
I agree. Their relationship with one another and how they're annoyed and, bicker and horse around with one another feels very grounded and real. And that is one thing that really is untouched by this incident. Like, he's scared, but also that's my brother. And that's a compelling factor, is once again, newly introduced to this. Because whenever someone's battling to unvampirize somebody, it's because, hey, that's the lady I want to sleep with. This is a problem.
Right. It's kind of, we've moved beyond, something other than romantic or sexual attraction, compelling you to save someone's life.
Exactly. Exactly. And to go back to Warner Brothers' dilemma here, because both Schumacher and the screenwriter he helps bring on, Jeffrey Boehm, who up until this point, like big thing he'd been credited for was 1983's The Dead Zone. So it's not like the guy can't write. But again, he had a great blueprint there and a hell of a director. But they both agree, this has got to be three things: sexy, funny, scary. All of those in one. And Warner Brothers is like, listen, you could probably do two out of the three, but there's no way you're going to be able to do all three. And then Schumacher starts casting with what Warner Brothers refers to, and this is a direct quote, a bunch of nobodies, including Jason Patrick, Kiefer Sutherland, Corey Haim, Jamie Gertz, Alex Winter. Like, they have all had real careers after this, but didn't have much of anything before it.
No, this was, so, this was, I think this was might have been the first time I had seen Kiefer Sutherland in something. And before that, he'd had mostly pretty small supporting roles.
He'd been cut out of one movie, basically. He shows up at the end of it, which is Against All Odds. Where the most, you know, famous thing about the end of that movie is a Madonna song.
Oh, not you're thinking of Not Against All Odds. At Close Range.
At Close Range. Well, it starts with an A, same difference.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're right.
He's not come here for real information, Gina.
He shows up like this courtroom scene, and you're like, wait a minute, who the hell is this guy?
Who's this motherfucker? With a very punchable face. And then the movie he does just prior to this, but has not come out by when he's being cast, is Stand By Me, which he is intensely great at being a Stephen King bully in.
Oh, yeah. Like, I can't pick. I realize that character, Ace Merrill, has, you know, shown up in other stories and played by other actors, but I feel like he really evoked who that character is. And I honestly would love to see him play him now.
Oh, my
God. Because it's Needful Things that Ace Merrill shows up in as a pretty significant character. And he's like,
he wants was like on his car during the body.
Right. Like he's like, I think he's like in his 40s or 50s. So he could still probably do it.
He could pull it off. I believe in Kiefer.
And again, also the character is supposed to have been kind of a little run to seed at that point. So it would, you know, make sense if he's like 45 and, you know, looks 10 years older.
Yeah. And it's basically Warner Brothers comes to Schumacher and says, listen, if you don't start casting bigger names, we're going to cut your budget in half.
I can't even. I'm trying to think back to who the big teen stars were then. And
I have no idea.
I'm honestly not think of who else would have been good in that part, those parts. I really can't. I'm just thinking like Brat Pack people. You could have gotten James Spader as in the Kiefer Sutherland role, but he's too old.
He's too old. You need, and listen, both of them are very snivelly, sexy people you could punch in the face. They have a smarm about them.
Right. They radiate smarmy menace.
Yes. But I feel like all those Brat Packers would say no to any of these roles. They feel beneath them at this point because they're like, where's my star vehicle? Where's my young blood? Where's, you know, my high school epic? I'm not fucking around with the vampires. And so, and that's the big thing about Jason Patrick is like, they keep offering him the role and he keeps turning it down. He's like, I'm not going to show up in vampire makeup. It's just going to kill the vibe. I'm going to look stupid and I don't want to look stupid. And I'm like, that's the thing about vampires. There's no vampire makeup. There's no vampire makeup. And they get towards the end of the filming and they're like, fuck, we got to show the vampires. Is there a point? And that's where they come up with bumpy forehead.
Yeah. It's like, I was going to say that it's not bad. Like, you know, they got the contacts, they got the teeth. And then like, you know, when I get certain full vamp, then like their faces get kind of like their foreheads get a little misshapen.
Yes. And vamp out is something that does not exist as a colloquialism before this movie. So again, these are little elements that start to show up in all these other pieces of media that start here. It's ground zero. So they have a budget of $14 million and Warner Brothers goes, guess what? You got 8.5, which means you don't show the vampires at the end and all the fly. You never see them fly.
It's all implied, but which I think is great. Like, yes. I love that scene in the parking lot when they're going after the guy that got into the fight with them. And then, the they lift it out of the car too.
So you don't
actually, you know, see them swooping down. You just, you know, you see someone getting, you know, pulled away and then you hear like kind of like laughing and screaming. Like, and it's like, I think that's way more effective than just having them like, you know, coming down on like, you know, cables or something.
like what Spielberg has to do with Jaws, because the shark isn't working. The lack of budget means they have to come up with a way to evoke what's happening without showing you what's happening. And it kind of works a little bit better. And now you've seen it to the point where you can't really get away with that so much anymore. You have to find a new way to hide that particular weenie. But with every raft of footage coming back from Schumacher, Warner Brothers is like, oh my God, this isn't sexy. This isn't funny. And it isn't scary. We're gonna get creamed. This is a shit sandwich. And then they have one test screening in Long Beach, California. And according to reports, it was treated like a rock concert. That's how much that audience loved this.
Yeah, that's the thing. Of course. Yeah, I mean, you can't have a bunch of middle-aged men watching this and being like, this isn't sexy. You
know? Who are these children?
It's like, no, I guess it wouldn't be sexy for you, would it?
Right. Yes. But they are so disconnected from the general culture that this is appealing to that they just can't conceive of how it works. And after that, Schumacher is kind of like, they give him a summer slot. All of a sudden, they're like, we need music videos that go with this. All right, this is something we can work with. This movie eventually makes 4 times its original budget back, which wasn't a ton of money. But again, the investment was so small. And when you see 4 times that investment, that's what you're looking for out of a movie.
Yeah, and it had a huge life on VHS and cable.
Right. It paid for itself like 1 billion times over at this point. Again, why do we need physical media? It does nothing for the studio other than give you an endless supply of money, dumb. Fucking idiots. So I want to get into what some of the naughtier, K-N-O-T-T, why? Elements of this and talk about the subtext of the time, because we're talking 1987 when it's coming out, 86 is when it's being filmed. And it should not be lost on anyone that Schumacher is a gay man in Reagan's America, post AIDS. Well, we're in the midst of an AIDS crisis. And if they were going to pick somebody to deliver a family-friendly vampire comedy, this was not the person to choose. Although he was a versatile enough filmmaker that, weirdly enough, he kind of becomes the guy who can kind of do a little bit of
everything. Yeah, he's had, the Spool, the website that I write for, we actually did a whole month on Schumacher movies right after he passed away. And it's astonishing how versatile he was. He did straight comedy, like DC Cab. DC Cab, Patrick?
I don't want to. I also don't want to remember The Incredible Shrinking
Woman. He did that.
A terrible movie.
He did an adaptation of Phantom of the Opera. He did an occult horror film with Henry Cable and Michael Fassbender. He did, of course, my favorite, Batman Forever. and then Batman and Robin.
Well, yeah. The important thing is he put nipples on the bat suit.
A lot of his 90s era success started with being given more opportunities after doing The Lost, because he had
yes.
You know, I like a lot of his movies, but nobody would accuse Joel Schumacher's movies of having a lot of substance to them. He had his finger on the pulse of what he thought would appeal to people and what he would have thought would appeal to a very hip audience. And, you know, in the 80s, the hip audience was teenagers. Not that that's changed, but, you know, understanding that, you know, keeping up with, like, the trends. So, you know.
Yes. Well, his film right before this is St. Elmo's Fire. It's once again, bringing the brand.
We talk about horror movies. Jeez. Oh, boy.
Well, but then, like, he comes off of this and does Cousins, which is a comedy remake of a French film. Then he goes back into horror with Flatliners, a movie I personally do not care
about. You know, I think it's funny that like, they kind of have differing ideas on, like, you know, for the characters, like, what the most horrible thing that ever happened to them was. And like, William Baldwin's was, well, I filmed some women having sex without their consent. Everybody else is like, well, I saw my father commit suicide in front of me, or.
I might have had a hand in my brother's death. It might have been an accident.
I participated in a hate crime. and we don't even see, like, poor old, what the hell Oliver Platt was haunted by. They just didn't bother with him.
Yeah.
Oliver Platt's nightmare was, oh my God, I'm always the second banana.
I'll never get out of this place in my career. And then he goes on, like, but after the, it's just all over the place. Like, Dying Young is not good. Falling Down is real dangerous territory because it's really, you're not meant to like that lead character, and yet you find
that is aggressively of the time.
Right. And then one of my favorites from him is The Client. I think The Client is fucking
That's the one with Susan Sarandon, right? And the kid, she's defending, yes. She's representing the kid. Yeah, that is a good one.
It is darn good. Then you have Batman Forever and A Time to Kill, like, back to back. Like, holy shit, here's a guy who knows how to do this one kind of genre, and we're also making him in charge of our big comic book franchise.
Yeah, he was printing his own money at that point.
And then just kind of, because of Batman and Robin, and then he goes into fucking 8mm, which is a follow-up to 7, of all things, in some ways. And then he goes into, all right, I'm going to do some small drama shit. So he does Flawless and Tigerland and Phone Booth and Veronica Guerin. And, like, this stuff is all very small, not franchise, but just, like, movies. And then that Phantom of the Opera. Wow. Yeesh to ish. That is, well, I just don't know how you make a good movie out of Phantom of the Opera. But he certainly had plenty of interesting talent associated with it.
He did. Like I said, he knew how to make his, at minimum, his movies always looked good. They always had a lot of visual flair. He always, you know, they looked very much, you know, they looked very contemporary. When you look at them now, you're not like, oh God, that's, well, okay, fine. Some movies look like back, you look back and say, oh God, that's embarrassing. But for the time, he was like, yeah, this guy knows what he's doing. And he did.
Yeah, he did. And I think he knew exactly what would make this pop. Because he like looked at the raw material and said, okay, here's what's going to appeal. We need to make this more queer. We need to make this more interesting. We need a group of hot guys dressed in leather, often shirtless, adorned in marching band gear, just prowling the streets for rough trade. And then they dangle out the one girl in the group, Star, as bait, and they always pick up something on the line. And that fucking works. That works.
Every time. There's not really much indication that they are stalking women. Like, they kind of, one of them kind of flirts with the gal who's working at Edward Herman's video store. I love that fucking video.
And they also, like, pick up on that one street trash gang's girlfriend, but it's always to get up
right. And yeah, and I think that they're, you know, kind of flirt with the girl at the video store just to annoy Max. And I love that fucking video store, baby. Oh my God, the good old days.
Back when a video store seemed cool.
I could smell the stale popcorn.
Also, you know who that girl is in the video store?
She's in summer school.
Yeah, it's Kelly Jo Binter.
Yeah, the girl he has teach to how to drive, so she'll pass the class.
From A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, baby. Our favorite Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's right, yeah.
And I say that in complete dick fingers, it is not. But, like, all of this is to set up one side of a family. That is one type of family, where you have a guy who has a bunch of vampire boys that he cannot fucking control. He can't even let them into his hip new video store. Tells them to get the fuck out.
Yeah, no, like, as soon as they walk in, you're like, ah, fuck. Yeah. I mean, like, obviously, this is before we know who he is.
Right.
You know, we just think he's just kind of this sort of schlubby, you know, guy who, you know, might be a, you know, someone for Lucy to go on a date with.
Yes.
But, like, you know, because he you know, very, very much passes off as, oh, here are these asshole kids who are probably going to, like, steal something from me.
Exactly. It's well within his rights. Like, those people are trouble, and I don't want them in my very respectable neon-drenched video store. Then you have the other family involved in this, which you only learned their last name because it appears to have been lost in the divorce. We've got another one of these. Even on IMDb, their last name is not listed. But finally, David at one point says, you know, Michael Emerson. I'm like, oh, that's his last name. Someone actually said his last name, everybody. So the Emersons, you have an aging hippie mom whose recent divorce has completely, you know, dislodged her children and landed her back in the home of her pot-smoking father in the murder capital of the world.
Let me ask you, was there anybody that, like, just gave off the air of, I need to protect you. You seem so nice and sweet as Diane Weiss.
Truly. She seems like so very, very nice. And they give her a save the cat moment here outside the video store where there's this lost kid crying for his mom. And she's like, how can I help you? And finally, the mom shows up and is like, oh, thank you. Thank you. So you can tell that in her heart of hearts, this is the sweetest woman in the world. And whoever this asshole is in Arizona who decided that he could do better, we know he's an idiot because
yeah, right?
Diane Weist. And then you get to the part of this that Santa Cruz, which is really where this takes place, was colloquially known for a little bit of time as the murder capital of the world because it gave birth to not one, not two, not three, but four serial killers, everyone.
Like, at the same time?
Over a course of years, yes. Until Seattle dislodged it in the nation's idea of where serial killers come from. It was...
Yeah, Seattle had a good run.
Yeah, they did. Way to go, Seattle. Everyone give it
well,
up.
Well, you know, it's funny. Like, people are like, oh, how come... I think we discussed this before, and you're... The theory is that it's because you have such a robust highway system.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
That it's you know, it's easy to get away from you know, the scene of a crime or yeah. to, you know, transport a body. Whereas, you know, in New York, like, what are you going to do? You're going to kill somebody and you're going to jump on the subway, which is why, like, people like David Berkowitz and the fellow that killed a number of sex workers actually did it outside the city. Mm-hmm. David Berkowitz was predominantly in Queens, and this fellow would take his victims back to Long Island mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because they had vehicles. You're not going to find too many serial killers, you know, regular one-time killers, sure.
On the spur of the moment, it seems like a good idea. The time killers.
Right, but serial killers, you know, have not really been much of a thing, like in the boroughs and Manhattan. Right. It's interesting, but anywhere where there's you know a lot of automobile traffic is where it's likely going to happen.
Yeah, and so you have this battle between these two unlikely but becoming more prevalent family types, and it is interesting that they are given equal time and that there are elements to the Lost Boys that are compelling and make you, like, consider them as a group you might hang out with. They are not just repellent monsters. They are monsters that draw you in.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're also like a few heavy hits that they've been sort of forced into this lifestyle. I don't mean to make that sound like sex trafficking or anything like that, but like, you know, you see the kid Laddie, you see his missing child poster,
right?
So you know, let's assume that Max has turned at some point over maybe the past 100 years. I mean, I do think that the outfits are a deliberate sartorial choice and not this is the clothes they were changed in.
Right.
I think, they want something. They're trying to stand out.
Yes.
Which, why that closing, that really memorable closing line really hits you. It's like, oh, everybody knows about these people. It's like, they're not trying to hide. They are wearing very noticeably different clothing. You know, they're just walking around on the rides and making eyes at people and start fights. Like, they're not trying to hide who they are. You know, the town knows they exist. So, you know, I think that this is a choice that they have made. But to get back to my point is that it's just kind of, almost a little bit like trafficking where I make you and then you make another one and the two of you bring someone else in, and now, we have our own little clubhouse of cool kids.
Yes.
And now it's, hey, what do you think? Maybe it's time for us to bring in a new one. And they just choose Michael.
And I also feel like Max is at a point where he can't control these kids be out of control.
Yeah, and I would assume that Max has a similar attitude as the head vampire in 30 Days of Night, where it's like, you can't keep making more of us. We're going to run out of food.
Right, yeah.
So, I had my and again, this is completely, my own story, my own assumption, is that, these were initially, these other, members of this little group were initially agreed upon because, whoever was the first one needed a friend, right. Needed someone to hang around with.
And like,
and minds. Then it kind of, right. And then it kind of grew from there. Yeah.
And if we're talking about little headcanons here, let's talk about the little almost serendipitous it like dairy thing that's going on in this town. Because if people do know that there are vampires around this burg, but they haven't done anything about it yet, I think there's an element to, well, because we know who they feed on. They feed on all the kids that we see in the opening credits of this. They feed on the surf punks. They feed on the homeless people. They feed on the raucous elements we don't want at our boardwalk. And this is fine. They can live with this because the Hoy and Poloy, who live up on the hills, well, they're not, battling vampires 24/7. It's this class of individual who's getting picked off one by one. And sure, it means we might have a reputation, but that reputation doesn't really cast a pall on my lifestyle when I show up with my giant shoulder pads to the local video store.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that.
And so when Max sees Lucy and sees that that she has two boys of a certain age and sees that she's a caring individual, well, why can't we just bring in a Wendy to deal with some of these lost boys?
Let's give you a mom.
Let's give you a mom. And she's a caring individual and she will put others before herself. And right towards the end, she pretty much demonstrates that she will put other people before her own safety. She offers her hand to a vampire because this is a no-win situation, and maybe her youngest son won't be turned into one. That says a lot about her, and it again brings in a human element to this fantastical story, which elevates it beyond the everyday.
Right, because Max would not sacrifice himself for his boys.
No, No. I mean, he comes in and he sees that David's dead and touches his face like, oh, you were my first. But you know what? This is the way you fucking chose to go about it.
It's, well, guess I'd start all over again.
Yeah. I'll just start with these people. Maybe I'll have a better luck. You know, maybe this was for the best. I don't need a bunch of guys who think that Jim Ride the Snake Morrison is someone that they need to model their lives after.
I'm sorry. I thought that that cave hangout was the coolest fucking shit when I was 15.
It is.
I mean, it's a tetanus shot waiting to happen. But I mean, if you had invited me over to hang out and eat Chinese food, hell fucking yeah. What time should I get there?
I mean, they've got that big Jim Morrison poster. They also have a hidden Munster Go Home poster in there. It's great. What's not to like?
Fantastic.
So if we haven't mentioned them before, David, Paul, Dwayne, and Marco are the new monkeys. I'm sorry. That's a typo. They're the Lost Boys. They just roam around Santa Carla, neon lit, filled with Mad Max rejects and gangs straight out of Death Wish 3, and pick off dumb motherfuckers one by one. And it seems to be going great for them.
They're just having a time of their lives.
When they kill off that security guard and he's trying to open that door, it does look like he's trying to hump the door.
Well, a little bit, yeah.
I know he's panicking, but it's a bit much. One thing you begin to notice in this is a lot of missing posters around Santa Carla, including one that looks mysteriously like my wife in junior high school. It's one of those things where was Nicolas Cage in the Civil War type of shit? It's just crazy.
Does she have a reflection?
She does. She does. And I think if she was about to feed on me, she would have done it by now. We've been sleeping in the same bed for a while.
She's had ample opportunity.
Yes. Whereas the costumers in this movie had ample opportunity not to dress Corey Haim like their distaff elements of Louis Anderson's wardrobe. He shows up in this movie with the largest fucking shirt I've ever seen on what was probably a 108-pound boy.
Yeah, he does. He does look like he's about to do a tight five at the evening at the improv.
Yeah, he's got a Chuckle Hut vibe. he's judging some of it. Honestly, some of his sweaters look like they fitted Diane Wiest, and they're like, "What do we do with the rest of the stuff she said no to?" And Corey Haim's like, "I'll wear it." There's just no way. It just feels like that. It is crazy. The outfits that they are putting him in. Later that night, they go and they see Tim Capello oiled up, touching a microphone like it's not going to send a current right through his body. And that's where we meet Jamie, the second best head of hair in all of 80s horror, Gertz, as Star. She and I feel like she's a lure. She's just this worm that the boys put on a hook to see what they can catch. If someone takes an interest in her and she's like, maybe you can get me out of this terrible situation. And they're like, yes. Also, we'll kill that person. Go back to the cave and sleep for a little while.
Yeah. And even she's also been sort of thrust into a maternal role with this little boy, Laddie, which I don't know. I have to question the practicalities and I asked the same question of Near Dark, which we do have to bring up because that came out the same year as this. And unfortunately, and took a completely different approach to it and unfortunately got a little trampled at the box office.
Once people get a particular flavor of what they like and you have a little bit of a phenomenon like that, and then Near Dark comes along, and a movie we absolutely should cover at some point during the season, and delivers a very different vision of that same dynamic. I just think a certain amount of audiences are like, no, I found the ice cream flavor I want. I don't need this. And they just turn their noses up to it, which is unfortunate because as much as I love The Lost Boys, I do feel that Near Dark is the superior movie. That
oh, yeah, I would 100% agree with you. I was going to say the same thing. I do think that The Lost Boys is the more influential movie. Mm-hmm. Near Dark is the more well-made movie.
Yes.
And what I was going to say was is that I question the practicalities of creating a child vampire.
Mm.
For one reason, because you eventually run into the issue of what the child vampire in Near Dark and also in Interview with the Vampire run into is, you know, being an adult with needs.
Yeah.
In a child's body.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just like, why do you guys need like a little brother?
But I think the motivation here, and then this is out of canon, this is completely made up in my head, but I have to assume because he's a more recent victim, because his picture is on a milk carton, that he was turned or half turned at the very least to keep Star in line. She might walk into the sun, if not because she wants to prevent Laddie from eventually turning fully. She thinks there's got to be some way out of this, but I won't just walk into the sun myself if Laddie's still around. I will do everything in my power to protect him from going all the way.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
I think the rice maggots trick, if I'm being honest, is one of the lamest uses of an incredible power ever committed to film. I mean, I love it. But if you can glamour people into thinking that they're eating worms, wouldn't you use that for better things than making people think they're eating worms?
Well, you know, you just, you know, give a little taste of what he can do.
And if like all of this is just a big whim-wham into fooling Michael into like, that was just rice. That was just noodles. This is just some Kool-Aid looking shit in an overly elaborate bottle and not blood, which you can tell the difference between wine and blood when you drink it.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some pretty gnarly tasting wine. I've never drank it and thought this might be human blood.
I don't know, this that bottle's so fancy. There's no way it could be human blood.
This dusty ornate bottle has blood in it.
And then there's that, what I feel is an advantage now is the very old school special effects charm of this movie. When it goes to a cliffside with a lighthouse, that's the most modeliest model shit in the entire world. And you're kind of like, I don't care. There's no such thing as real vampires. I don't need this to be real. That can be models. When they go up on the bridge and it's all fog underneath them, and that bridge is actually like a couple feet over the ground.
Like I was gonna say, their feet are like about 6 inches off the ground. Yeah,
yeah. There's a reason why they like fall with their back through the fog. It's because the ground is very close to where that fog is. And then they kind of do it, and then they like replicate it in a studio and whatnot. But all that stuff is just very old school models, you know, that foreground shot that shows you like it's high off a cliff. It's a painting. It just, you gotta love it. You gotta love it. It's quaint.
I do love it. And you know, we've touched upon the homoeroticism in the movie. Mm-hmm. And you know, and people love to be, you know, say stuff like, oh, you know, sometimes it's a cigar, and you know, don't, why do you always have to read, you know, so much into it? And like Kiefer Sutherland himself had no issue agreeing that, yeah, this feels, you know, there's definitely a sexual chemistry happening between his character David and Michael.
Yeah, there's a reason why Michael keeps yelling, just you and me.
Right. Yeah. Now, you know, I don't know if he understood then as however the hell old he was, you know, 25 or so.
Sure.
You know, but you know, as you know, you a person with experience, you know, now, you know, you can look back and like, oh yeah, I could see why people would have thought that. Yeah. And you know, and when the people in a movie in the actual movie can say, yes, I can, you know, while maybe not necessarily intentional, I can see why people would have that read. You know, you don't get to say, oh, you know, that's just your interpretation of it.
Right. Whereas that sort of out of place Michael and Star sex scene feels very studio mandated.
It feels very like, yeah, we need to make it crystal clear that this kid is only interested in this girl.
This needs a hot beef injection of heterosexuality into it.
But even then, in keeping with this is a movie for teenage girls.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't take her clothes off at all, which I think is hilarious. like you know, all he does for all we can do is take his shirt off. Yeah. So we get some beefcake.
She drops a spaghetti strap, and then it's a lot of slow motion sexy dojo shit.
It's very soft lit. It's very, you know, it's almost a little, you know, you got that kind of like a sheer covering. You know, you expect to see a dove flying out somewhere. But like, it's a little too romance novel cover for like, you know, two teenagers having sex.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But like, but yeah, that is, you know, that serves two purposes. It's, you know, it's acknowledging who the target audience is, you know, teenage girls who don't want to see a graphic sex scene.
Exactly.
And also to, you know, you make it, you know, very apparent that, you know, what you think you're seeing, you're not actually seeing that. Right. And then later, oh no, you actually were seeing that.
But I think the flip side to Star is that she is by very definition this sexy, dangerous baby born yesterday. Like, it takes her 2/3 of this movie to say, oh, we're half vampires. He comes there is like, what the hell happened? And she's like, I can't explain it to you. Why can't you? The only way you can explain it to me is with your vagina? That is a weird way to explain shit. It is a grand disservice to her character. But again, this movie is not heavy on the female empowerment. Let's put it that way.
No, it's like, it is her and Lucy are the only female characters.
Yes. And one brief shot of Kelly Jo Minter.
She says like a word, not even like an entire line. She may even just laugh when one of them is like hitting on her.
Yeah.
Is funny because she does get an opening credit.
Right.
Which suggests she had more to do at some point.
My guess is that she had lines or was talked to a little bit more, probably not a predominant role, but just to explain, like, she must be running that store during the daytime because Max certainly isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume there's probably some scene where, you know, Sam goes in there to find out more about Max because, as children of divorce often do, I speak from experience with this. He takes an immediate dislike to Max, not immediately because he knows he's a vampire, but because he just, you know, wants to date his mom.
Yeah.
And that's weird. Yeah. And so, you know, I assume that some, you know, she plays into that somehow. I always think that's funny when they don't bother going back and taking someone's name out of the opening credits when their role has been pared down to almost nothing.
But that credit's been negotiated as part of the contract. So regardless of whether or not her role, you know, if she has an image on film, she's going to retain that credit. That's just a union thing.
Oh, okay.
But it's still weird because you have to wonder what the hell is going on here. This is where we kind of get a bigger twist on the vampire rules because they test Max by feeding him garlic and throwing holy water in his lap and nothing happens. And he shows up in a mirror. He later explains that if you would invite a vampire in that invalidates all of that shit, then why wouldn't it invalidate, you know, having a spike go through your fucking chest, you know?
Yeah, that seems to be playing a little fast and loose with things.
Yeah. Again, you found an out I just don't know that it's a super consistent out with the rest of the movie. Again, we don't come to the Lost Boys for like
it is a true vibe.
Yes, absolutely. That's in my notes. This movie is a vibe.
Is it scary? Not particularly.
We showed it to Oliver, and he did jump twice. So
it is. I would say, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think it's even with today's youth.
Yeah.
I do think it actually is a pretty good introduction to horror, because it the one time it gets a little bloody is when they attack the people having the beach party. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a pretty long shot of one of them biting into someone's head, like blood squirts out, mm-hmm. and I think someone gets their neck snapped, and you know, that's probably about as, to me, as violent as it gets, other than, you know, how they actually kill off the vampires.
And those are so fantastical that you kind of get into the same Raimi territory.
Right, they're just slaying monsters at that point.
Yes.
But, so yeah, I think for like the like 11 to 12-year-old set, it's a good introduction.
It's a great introduction, because it's brief, it tells a very quick tale.
It's funny.
Yeah. And, you know, outside of the outfits, it still plays.
You know, I think certainly, again, in getting, as we discussed with Sam, as being, you know, sort of, you know, awkward, desperately trying to be cool 14-year-old, mm-hmm. you know, he's still very relatable.
Yeah.
And I think now, you know, whether intentionally or not at the time, the whole, you know, well, he's clearly confused about, you know, who he's attracted to. You know, I think for an adolescent audience now, that would be even more relevant.
Right. Just because there's no one comments on it. It's not a subject matter of the movie.
No,
the
like, movie doesn't
care about it.
Right. I mean, my guess is like some middle-aged set designer said, well, you know, let's put some things up that teenagers would think is cool.
Yes.
And it's like, well, what's big with the teens? Molly Ringwald and Rob Lowe.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, we have this blank space. Can anybody run out and get something? And it's like, well, I went to this video store. They're throwing out posters, and it was either Sophie's Choice or Reform School Girls. So I grabbed Reform School Girl.
Reform School Girls sounds transgressive and fun, and something that a teenager would put up on his wall. If I could have gotten away with it, I totally would have put a Reform School Girls poster on my fucking wall.
Right next to the giant swatch.
Right. I don't know so much about the Rob Lowe thing. That's just setting up an expectation for me that I'm not going to meet. I'm not going to have that sexy of a tummy. I don't look that good in white. It's just not going to...
Yeah, I think the idea was that you know, Sam just thought he was cool.
Yes. And he dresses like him. Let's put that out there. He's dressing like that.
Right. But I think, you know, if you know, someone, you know, who was a little confused about how they felt about people now would be like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And so we have this big denouement at the end where they start in the sexy dojo cave, and they kill off Alex Winter, and he becomes a giant goo mess. And then because the vampires now know that this group knows they're vampires, their mission is search and destroy. Once the sun goes down, the coast is toast, as they say.
Also, I do love, and I presume that you have that, the really high-end HD television.
Yeah.
One thing that I particularly enjoy is that when the vampire's blood goop, mm-hmm. whatever you would call it, dries, apparently it looks like craft glitter. Yeah.
Well, they had to make it, I assumed this, right? You're trying to make it so that in these darker moments, it shows up on screen. So you want it to reflect a little, and then you film that next scene and you're like, well, bring up that tub of goo because we're going to want to match. And then they put it on, like, oh shit, that kind of sparkles. And I'm like, okay, we're fine. Nobody cares. And they just move on. And yeah, I don't think it showed up so much on your VHS tape, but
yeah, no, if you want, yeah. And then the 4K and like the 65 inch soda is like, oh, they had an accident in the art room.
I honestly don't think it's an accident. I think it's a trick to make it show up on film better in a space that is very darkly
lit. Oh, no, no, no. I meant like it looks, I'm just making like someone had an action in the art room and just spilled like glitter glue all over themselves.
Yeah, of course. That bathtub of holy water.
Holy water and garlic bulbs.
Garlic bulbs, which we're told I love that
kind of very childlike innovation of, you know, what do we know about vampires? Well, they don't like holy water. They don't like garlic.
Put them in a water gun. We're good to go.
It makes sense.
And then when Bordello of Blood does it, it's not quite as cool.
No.
We're going to have to talk about Bordello of Blood.
Must we?
I'm afraid we'll have to. So
you know who else is in Bordello of Blood? Corey Feldman.
Corey Feldman in his last good role. I think Corey Feldman's going off in that one, and I'm kind of here for it. That is half a good movie and half a terrible movie. And it can never quite find its footing, unlike the first Tales from the Crypt movie. This was my first idea for Halloween. I've walked away from this. My first idea for Halloween was we do all three of the Tales from the Crypt movies.
Wait, there's a third one?
There is a third one. It's about zombies.
No idea.
They made it and were about to put it in theaters, and Bordello of Blood did so badly that Universal was like, does anyone want this? And it became an artisan film, and they released it on DVD.
I had no idea. Because I love the first one.
Yes. I think that movie is pretty damn good. It really knows what it wants to do, and it has the feeling of that show without being just a movie version of the show.
Right. And it's like so fucking gory. I love it so much.
Great character actors. There's a ton of great character actors in that movie. And it all just kind of pops as a result. And then you get to the Bordello of Blood, and they're way more focused on the boob element than anything else.
Right.
And they're relying on the charm of Dennis Miller, which.
Oh, boy.
That sentence alone should send a shiver down everyone's spine.
To its detriment.
Let's not talk about Bordello of Blood anymore. I love the dog has the assist. That was my son's favorite part. Death by Stereo, just for those in the know, in the Blu-ray extras, during that test screening, people laughed over that line. So it takes so long to get to Death by Stereo because it was elongated so that people's cheering and laughter slowed down for the joke.
like the Happy Days thing where they walk in, the character walks into the scene and stops and waits for the studio audience to applaud.
Right, waits for the woos to die down before he starts delivering dialogue. I just want to say for everybody that Death by Stereo is not a get bunked because the arrow is what is doing the killing. It's
the arrow pushes him into the stereo.
Into the stereo. He does not go through the stereo into him. So that, therefore, it is not a get bunked. Kiefer dies by antler, and then Max gets a giant fence pole through the chest.
With La Cucaracha playing.
A La Cucaracha that really has trouble completing, really has trouble getting there in the second half. And then it's revealed by Grandpa that he's always known that there are vampires around, which is all the information you should say out loud to people.
And I don't think he's the only one that knows. Yeah. I stand by my belief.
I think this is a good point. Anything else that we may have missed or need to talk about when it comes to the Lost Boys?
I do like that Grandpa grows weed.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like that he has a bumper sticker in his refrigerator that says Old Fart.
Where he stashes his root beer and Oreos.
His secret stash of root beers are not allowed to touch. I mean, I get it. I love root beer, so.
I've said this before. I wish I was the kind of person who got hungry after they smoke weed, but I do not. I don't ever get the munchies. It's not something that happens to me.
I think about food.
Sure.
Is that weird? I don't particularly like want to eat food, but I'll think about it.
Yeah, sure. food's fun to think about. It makes total sense. So listen, we can't close the coffin lid on the Lost Boys without playing Choose Your Own Death Venture. And that's where we decide of the deaths portrayed in this motion picture, if we were forced to die that way, which one would we choose and why? Up for bid in this motion picture is killed when you've just gotten off work. Your door is ripped off.
I guess we have to assume that they're just, these people are just kind of bled and then tossed somewhere, maybe in the ocean.
Probably right in the ocean. Why not? Far enough out that you don't see the light of day, or that you get thrown on the funeral pyre. Killed when your car becomes a convertible, times two. Get your neck snapped, your throat torn out, the back of your skull bitten off. There's one guy who gets scalped, which is pretty nasty, and staked. And then we get to the sort of vampire deaths here. Staked upside down and just spill salad dressing.
With your little, hanging upside down by your little bat beak.
Your little Alex Winter curly mullet. What is going on with that hair?
He's got three different hairstyles going on. Patrick, do you realize this is the second thing we've done in a row, which involves a character with a rat tail?
I didn't realize that until this moment, but it does feel like some sort of weird cosmic
thing. He's got a little mullet, sure. But he's also got the curly hair, but he's also got the rat tail.
It's one of those things that you learn on Project Runway. You got to look in the mirror and take one thing off. And they're like, add a rat tail? No, that's the wrong thing to do. Oh, fuck, they filmed it. What are you going to do? You get karate kicked by a dog into a bathtub filled with holy water, melt. Come up for a skeleton hug. We've got arrow to the chest, then death by stereo. Speared by antlers, get the angel lights. I don't know what is angelic about David here, but oh my God. His death is like, oh.
Well, it's like, I guess it's sort of like, you know, oh, he was just a kid.
He's just a sweet boy.
His little baby face.
You just shaved that scruff and he's a sweet old boy. Listen, he's got the sweet little boy face in Stand By Me. He's still a very punchable asshole.
He's such a piece of shit in that. Oh my God.
Truly. He just has that in his DNA. I don't know what that's about, but you just don't. He's got a smarm and a mullet. It's like a smarm mullet. And then of course you get staked by a fence pole, explode in a fireplace.
Oh, wow. I mean, you know, Part of me, you know, even at my advanced age, would still like to be a Lost Boy. Mm-hmm. So I may take one of the vampire deaths. I think I will actually take knocked into a bathtub full of holy water and garlic by a dog. Because I love me a good skeleton hug.
Sure, and he comes up for one. He's trying to give as many skeleton hugs as he possibly can.
And then I. But then on the other hand, I feel bad. I totally fuck up grandpa's house.
That's the problem with killing vampires. They're hell on your fucking plumbing.
Because calls all my goop just like just backs up the plumbing in the whole house. That's a lot of goop. That's he produced a lot of goop.
Like, so he's vampire Drano? Is that what that is?
I think it's just like his goop just pumping through the pipes.
Yeah. But he destroys a toilet. That's a lot.
Like a toilet explodes? Yeah. The kitchen sink blows up? That is an excessive amount of goop.
Both floors. Like the kitchen is a mess as well. It's a whole thing. That's
that's going out in a big way. And I like that.
True. Whereas I like to be put out of my misery early. So that may make you think that you get your neck snapped. But I have to be a surf Nazi before that. And I'm not. So I'm going to go with arrow to the chest, death by stereo.
I knew you were going to pick that one. I knew it.
It just feels very me.
It does feel very you.
Just make a mistake and lots of sparks fly everywhere. That feels very me.
And, you know, I trust you'd be able to talk with your fake vampire teeth slightly better than that actor.
I'm not sure. Those are giant choppers they've put. Yeah, he's
the other ones do okay with it. He's struggling a little bit.
He's God a model. Bless. He's a pretty model. So
yeah, he's doing a little bit of this.
They're trying to keep the strength in his mouth when they're talking. It's not scary.
No.
But Josh Hollis does all of our artwork. Go to joshhollis.com for that and so much more. Go to revengebodymemphis@bandcamp.com for this song or all of our remixes. Gina, where can people find you on these here internets?
I write about boobies and television at spool.net. I have a newsletter, ginawatchesthings.substack.com. And I am on all social media except Twitter X under Gina Does Things.
Do it today. People, check it out. And, you know, we're on the socials with the exception of Twitter. Fuck that place. More importantly, go to our Patreon where we have tons of bonus episode content for you to listen to, including movie commentaries, which are super fun. Last month, we did a bonus episode on Gymkata where you got the skill of gymnastics and the kill of karate, and you visit a town of cannibals who cut their own hands off if they don't like how it's going.
I mean, don't miss this, people. That's another month. Honestly, it is something special.
It truly is. And we answer your questions in chat by chat, movie commentaries, and more. You gotta do it, and you'll help us so much. You know, another thing you can do if you're new to the podcast or you've been listening to us for a long time, and that is rate and review us on iTunes or whatever your podcatcher of choice is. Rate an episode 5 stars on your Spotify's. Go to Good Pods, Herd FM, all these social media integrated things where ratings apply. We'd love to have your 5 stars or more. Give us 15. The stars don't cost you money. Go for it. Recommend us to friends on social media as well. It's always helpful to help the show grow and be seen and heard by more and more people. You can find us on YouTube now. That's the thing. Anyways, don't worry, folks. The body count will continue. For myself and for Gina, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.